Episode 87, General McClellan, General Grant, and the Battle of Shiloh. Hi, my name is Clayton Mills. Welcome to A Short Walk Through Our Long History, a podcast where we look at the events of history and examine how those events shaped our modern world. At this point, in late 1861, the war is not going well for the Union. The early battles of the Civil War were mostly Union defeats, or at least draws, where the rebel army got away. There were not any definitive victories, that's for sure. And because of that, the Confederacy still existed and was still a threat. It was sort of like the American strategy during the Revolutionary War. As long as General Washington and the Continental Army still existed, the British hadn't won. Similarly, as long as the Confederacy still existed, the Union had not won. And this gave hope to the Confederates and frustrated the people of the Union. Lincoln could see that this was going to take more than 90 days, so he put out a call to the states to provide 1 million men, this time for a 3-year enlistment. And Lincoln removed General McDowell from command of the Army of the Potomac. He replaced him with General George McClellan. First McDowell, then McClellan. You'd think this was Macbeth, not the U.S. Civil War. General McClellan had been put in charge of the Union forces in West Virginia, which is now the state of West Virginia, but at the time it was just Western Virginia. But the west of Virginia is very mountainous, and it's not dominated by slaveholding plantations, and the whole area's sympathy was mostly with the North, not the South. That's one of the reasons it became its own state later. So McClellan cleared the area of its relatively small Confederate forces pretty quickly, which brought him attention in Washington. McClellan was not tall. He was like 5'6". And so he got the nickname the Napoleon of the West, since the prevailing notion at the time of Napoleon was that he was short, even though he also was actually average for his time. McClellan, like Napoleon, was fond of military spectacle and loved to dress in the fanciest dress military uniform that he could find. He loved to ride at the front of large parades. He was apparently very fond of military parades and of having the army look good. Lincoln promoted McClellan to be the commander of the Army of the Potomac, which was one of the highest honors, one of the highest positions in the army at the time. McClellan set about organizing the army and teaching it how to drill. And by drill, I don't mean teaching it how to fight. He was very insistent on the army being able to march in formation and look good while doing it. He led some very impressive parades around the Washington area, and to his credit, he did give the army a new sense of pride and maybe some confidence. They did have a lot of soldiers anyway, and they looked good in a parade. But what he didn't do was, well, anything other than parades. All he did was prepare. Lincoln kept trying to get him to move the army out and attack. But by the end of 1861, it was getting close to winter, and it was clear McClellan wasn't going anywhere. I told you McDowell was slow. McClellan took it to a whole new level. Meanwhile, while McClellan was dawdling and parading around Washington, there were other battles going on in other parts of the country. I guess I should say other countries, because at the moment it's really two different countries at war with one another. There's the Union in the North and the Confederacy in the South. Anyway, the first Battle of Bull Run had happened in mid-July, and for the rest of 1861, there were battles in a variety of other places, including Missouri, West Virginia, Kentucky, Florida, and Oklahoma. Most of them were either Confederate victories or just draws. But as I said, for the Confederates, a draw was really a win. All they had to do was stay alive and still be able to fight, and the Union couldn't say that it had won. So the year of 1861 closed out looking pretty bleak for the Union. They had an army sitting in Washington that wasn't doing anything, and they really hadn't won any major victories. In the beginning of 1862, in February, Lincoln's 5-year-old son, Willie, got typhoid fever, and he died. Now, this was really, really hard on Lincoln, but it was apparently even harder on his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, who might have gone completely insane as a result. It's not clear if she completely went insane, but she definitely wasn't herself for a while. It was a rough February in the Lincoln household there in the White House. Then, in March, the Confederates unveiled their new, fully functional battle station. No, I mean, it wasn't a battle station. It was the world's first ironclad naval vessel. The Confederate Navy took an old wooden boat that was named the Merrimack. They took off its sails, they put in a boiler and a steam engine, and they covered the ship with sloped iron plates. Not much stuck up above the waterline except for the sloped top, which had portholes that they could lift up and fire cannons out of. It looked sort of like a barge with a big metal lean-to on it, but it terrified the Northern Navy. The Confederates renamed the ship the Virginia. On March 8th, the Virginia sailed out of the James River, which was the river that Richmond was closest to, and is the river that ships would sail into and out of if they were able to trade with Richmond. But the Union had blockaded the river with 6 Union frigates, sailing ships, all of them. The Virginia sailed out into a barrage of fire from the Union ships, who were all astounded when their cannons did no damage at all. The cannonballs just bounced off of the Virginia. The Virginia rammed and sank the Union ship Cumberland, and then rammed and cannonaded another Union warship, which also sank. 3 more Union ships ran aground that day trying to flee from the Virginia. The next day, the Virginia sailed back out to go and finish off the 3 grounded ships. But on the way, they were met by an even stranger-looking ship that looked like a flat barge with a big round boiler on the top. This was the Union's first ironclad. It's called the Monitor. The Monitor and the Virginia started firing away, and inside the iron ships, the noise was such that many men's eardrums burst. But neither ship could damage the other, and at the end of the day, they both disengaged and sailed back to their harbors. The world's first battle of ironclad ships was not a clear victory for either side, but the Union did manage to protect and rescue the stranded ships. So maybe day 1 was a Confederate victory, but day 2 was kind of a Union victory? Okay, we'll call it a draw. Either way, naval warfare was forever changed. Both the Virginia and the Monitor were ships that could not go very far out to sea because they were both very low and very top-heavy, and they would take on water in a heavy sea. And they were also pretty slow. But the idea had been proven, and soon, all warships would be made of iron. And of course, the military being what it is, they got bigger and bigger and more powerful and more powerful. And now the U.S. Navy is perhaps the strongest military force in all of history, all because of the Monitor and the Virginia. But back on land, McClellan was still puttering and parading around Washington, making the Army feel good about itself, but not making the Army actually, you know, fight. Out west, however, we're about to meet a Union general who can and will fight. In north central Tennessee, there are 2 rivers that run kind of parallel to each other, the Tennessee River and the Cumberland River. They were both controlled by the Confederacy because there were 2 major Confederate forts on each river, and those forts controlled the flow of ships up and down both rivers. On the Tennessee River, there was Fort Henry, and on the Cumberland River, there was Fort Donelson. So Fort Henry, Fort Donelson. The Union wanted to control these rivers, so they needed to take out both of these forts. But there were also about 20,000 Confederate soldiers in and around the forts. The Union general who was tasked with taking these forts was Ulysses S. Grant. Grant was in some ways the polar opposite of McClellan, although, like McClellan, he was also short. Grant was sloppy. He hated the spotlight. He did not care at all about military parades and drills. But he did care about getting his army into a good position for a fight, and he was good at getting the army the provisions it needed. And when he got engaged in a fight, he stuck to it, and he usually won. Grant had fought in the Mexican-American War, so he had some combat experience. Now, early in the Civil War, as a colonel, he had led his men up a hill into a battle against a larger Confederate force. He admitted later that he was scared to death at this moment, but when they got to the top of the hill, the Confederate force had abandoned the position and marched away. Grant, apparently, in this moment, realized that the Confederates were as scared of him as he was of them, and he took that lesson to heart. From then on, wherever he was, he kept his forces always putting pressure on the Confederate armies that he faced, keeping them worried and fearful and trying to press the attack. He was always going to be on the offensive. Again, the opposite of McClellan. So, there in Tennessee, Grant and the Union troops took both Fort Henry and Fort Donelson. And at Fort Donelson, they actually captured about 15,000 Confederate troops. The Confederate commander at Fort Donelson was an old West Point friend of Grant's, a guy named Simon Buckner. And when Grant asked for the surrender of the fort, Buckner asked him to give them the chance to abandon the fort and march away. But Grant wrote back, "There will be no terms except unconditional surrender." So Grant got a new nickname. He became known as Unconditional Surrender Grant, following his initials, U.S. Grant. It's also a good nickname, but not quite as good as Stonewall. Eventually, Buckner surrendered. It was the first real Union victory, and the news was rapidly spread to Washington, which brought the first bit of good news that Lincoln had had so far. But that joy was a bit short-lived because just a bit more than a month later, this war is going to get really, really serious. Grant marched his army down the Tennessee River, and they were camped along the river near a church called the Shiloh Church. They knew that a Confederate army led by General Albert Sidney Johnston and P.G.T. Beauregard was close by. Grant was planning on finding them and attacking, but he didn't know how close they really were. On the morning of April 6th, 1862, while the Union forces were still camped and preparing breakfast, Johnston's men came screaming out of the nearby woods. The Union troops were completely unprepared, totally taken off guard, and they scattered, though some began to rally down near the river. The Confederate troops captured the nearby front edges of the camps of two of the more inexperienced units, who were actually under the command of General William Tecumseh Sherman. More on him later. Since his troops were green and unprepared, many of them ran, but Sherman, to his credit, managed to regroup them right near the Shiloh Church. But what really stopped the Confederate advance that morning was that they stopped to have breakfast. The Union camps had just started cooking, and the Confederate soldiers, some of whom hadn't eaten in a couple of days, just stopped and ate the Union breakfast. And then they began looting the camps for things like new rifles and shoes, which many of them were missing. Some of the Confederate units pressed forward, though, and there was fighting all up and down the river. There was one area around a stretch of abandoned road that was called the Sunken Road, where some of the fiercest fighting took place. The Confederates named the area the Hornet's Nest because of all the bullets buzzing around. Grant and Sherman effectively rallied their scattered troops, and they held the lines for the rest of the afternoon despite fierce fighting all up and down the lines and thousands of casualties. And one of the casualties was Confederate General Johnston, who had ridden his horse to the front of the lines to lead his men. He was shot through the leg, but he didn't realize it for a while until he nearly fell from his horse from dizziness. His men took him down, but he bled to death there on the field before any help could arrive. At the end of the day, the two sides dug in, but the Union was still receiving fresh reinforcements coming up the river. All night long, Union gunships in the river fired into the Confederate lines, and all night long you could apparently hear the cries of the wounded men out in the no man's land between the two lines. In the morning, Grant ordered a massive attack all along the lines, all across the battlefield, and the exhausted Confederate troops soon retreated. And once they got off the battlefields, they fled and marched back to Mississippi. Grant hadn't destroyed Johnston and Beauregard's army, but he had beaten it badly. But this battle was the bloodiest battle of the war so far. The total casualties for both sides were over 23,000. More Americans were killed in the Battle of Shiloh than had been killed in the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, and the Mexican-American War combined. In comparison, the Battle of Bull Run, the first battle, had only had about 4,700 casualties. This battle was almost five times of that. Both armies were too battered to go on fighting, but the Union had driven off the Confederate army, and so the Union claimed it as a victory. And this was indeed big news back in Washington. President Lincoln wanted to capitalize on this success, so he again urged McClellan to, go do some of that army stuff and actually fight another army. But McClellan was still moving very, very slowly. But eventually, the army left Washington. In early May, they boarded ships and they sailed down the Potomac and they landed on a peninsula on the north side of the James River in Virginia. They landed on the same peninsula where Jamestown, the first permanent settlement in Virginia, had been founded in May of 1607, 250 years earlier. It was also the same peninsula where the Battle of Yorktown had been fought, ending the Revolutionary War 80 years earlier. McClellan slowly inched up the peninsula, slowly getting closer to Richmond. Robert E. Lee, who was commanding the Army of Northern Virginia, didn't know exactly where McClellan was, so he sent out his best cavalry officer to scout for him. That cavalry officer was Jeb Stuart, who was a risk-taking leader, but he was also indispensable to Lee. Stuart rode out all the way around McClellan's army, got behind the army, burned Union supply wagons and supply depots, and he brought back several hundred Union prisoners. Plus, he told Lee exactly where McClellan was. So then, for the next 7 days, Lee attacked McClellan's much bigger force every single day. The Southerners fought with a lot more energy than the Northerners, feeling that they had this sense that they were defending the very heart of their own territory, and they drove back the much larger Union army. This set of battles that took place over 7 days became known as the 7 Days. The battles were bloody, and over the course of the week, there were over 30,000 casualties, more than even Shiloh. Lee lost more men than McClellan, but the Union army was again forced to withdraw, which was a huge victory for the South and a huge embarrassment for the North. Now, Lincoln wanted to fire McClellan, who had been very tentative and slow during the whole campaign, but Lincoln couldn't fire him because he knew McClellan was extremely popular in the army, and Lincoln could not risk an army uprising. So, here we are at the midpoint of 1862. The Union has the larger army, but they still have only defeated the Confederates in one major battle at Shiloh, and that had been very costly. Spirits in the North and in the Northern Army were very low. Lincoln wanted to make a bold stroke to rally the support of the North, and he proposed to his cabinet that he wanted to issue a proclamation that all the slaves would be made free and see if the news of that would affect the slaves in the South and maybe even cause a slave uprising. But Lincoln's cabinet were firmly against the idea, especially because the momentum of the war was not at that point going in the Union's favor, and they felt it just wasn't the right time. They needed a big win before they could make that kind of proclamation. So Lincoln put the idea in a drawer, waiting for a big enough Union victory to justify making that kind of announcement. Lincoln and the North are about to get that victory, but at the cost of the single bloodiest day in the history of America. Join me next episode for the Battle of Antietam and the Emancipation Proclamation.